That was great this morning, John. Thank you. Thank you very much. Kind of reminder of what an extraordinary man Apostle Paul was. He has a bad rap these days in many circles. I was always fond of him, and I could never quite see the big contrast between him and Jesus, as some people want to highlight. So thank you, John. And Sue, you started nicely introducing me simply by saying Miroslav and then kind of corrected yourself and brought in the Wolf and then the professor and then Yale and so forth. You should have just dropped that last part. So what I plan to do this morning is to kind of have a narrow focus for those of you who have attended a Richard Johnston lecture on narrow focus on the kind of what I gestured toward in the last part of that lecture. As you recall, we started yesterday morning talking about relationship between religion and then more narrowly Christian faith and violence. And at a Richard Johnston lecture, I tried to sketch out kinds of political arrangements that are presupposed if Christian faith is to be publicly engaged and yet not, at least institutionally, and in terms of arrangements, prone to violence. And in today's lecture, what I want to do is to explore further this nexus of the relationship between religious exclusivism and affirmation of political pluralism. Now, the reason why I am concentrating on this, because I think it's one of the prevalent sensibilities of our time. And it's interestingly enough, not just prevalent in the secular sphere, but it's also prevalent in the religious sphere. And you've got this alignment almost of secularists and religious folks who think that religious exclusivism is going to lead to exclusivism in the political realm. When I was teaching this course, I mentioned it here, on faith and globalization, I said every single time, for one of the first questions about the whole topic of religions and globalization was just that. And I remember the first question, it was a very prominent, actually I had not realized it then, but he's a very prominent Muslim leader, very young Muslim leader in United States, who was doing PhD at Yale. He was in that class, and then in that class, he raised his hand immediately and then asked his question. And obviously, he thought that there is a kind of correlation between religious exclusivism and political exclusivism as well. So let me, so what I plan to do right now is kind of go relatively quickly through the materials. I'll sketch for you the contrast between religious exclusivism religious exclusivism and pluralism, and then political exclusivism and pluralism, go into some critiques of it, and then end with where are the Baptists? Not Thomas Helwys, who was the Baptist, one of the first Baptists, together with John Smith in Amsterdam, and wrote the first Baptist Confession of Faith. And after he wrote the first Baptist Confession of Faith, wrote this book about mystery of iniquity, which I was mentioning, which is kind of the foundation of what I would describe pluralism as a political project. But I'll concentrate instead on my hero, Roger Williams, in a state right next to Connecticut up north. So that's roughly how we're going to go relatively quickly through our materials. So basically, religious exclusivism. What is religious exclusivism? I think you have it for us as Christians expressed probably most clearly in the statement in John's Gospel, very famous one. I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. So exclusivism here has three related aspects. They concern the truth, they concern the right way of life, and they concern access to both. First truth, religious exclusivists believe that their faith is the only true faith. Not so much that there's no other truth outside of their faith, which some do, but most, I think, don't. But that claims of their faith, claims of our faith, trump all the other claims. So you may find the truth there, but it'll be true if it's resonant with what you find in your own faith. And the second, exclusivists emphasize that their faith alone is the right path to God, that it alone fosters authentic human flourishing, that it alone assures the hope for eternal destiny. Again, it's not that outside of that faith is all pure darkness, but again, the faith tells you normatively what is the right way, and then other things may line up or may not line up. And finally, there's a question of access to truth. Religious exclusivists think that the final source of our authority, especially if they're monotheists, is the positive revelation contained in holy books and sacred traditions. That's even the case for those who don't believe strictly in revelations like Buddhists. They emphasize the importance of sacred writings that for them have authority much greater than just any claims to truth that you can then kind of examine, figure out, discard, or take. I mean, there's something special about those sacred books. And maybe just a comment on divine revelation. You know, revelation stands in contrast to either what, if you sit down deep in your thoughts, you can excogitate, and it stands in contrast to what if you go on a search, either with binoculars or with a microscope, you can find out, right? But it's somehow beyond what we can come up with ourselves in either of these two ways, it's given to us. There's kind of a positivity to revelation. And that's also a feature of most of the exclusivist faiths. Now, religious pluralism, basically you're familiar with that all major world faiths are roughly equally true, provide equal access to the divine reality, foster human flourishing equally well, and they're kind of like different dress codes, attuned to different climates, different cuisines that people have developed, but roughly they give you equal access to what profoundly matters. Now, comparable to these stances of religious exclusivism and pluralism, and for me it's absolutely central to distinguish between these and then ask about the relationship, right? Political exclusivism and pluralism are roughly look something like this. Political pluralism basically gives precedence to one particular ideology, one particular faith over all others, and it allows, exclusivism allows that faith to dominate the entirety of the public space. Most extreme forms of political exclusivism are totalitarianism, and as you recall, in the 20th century, it was a century of totalitarianisms, and none of them were actually religious in nature. All of them were quasi-religious in nature, whether that was Nazism or it was varieties of forms of Marxism. That's 20th century, but if you look back from the 20th century in the past, then you will find that actually the majority of totalitarianisms were actually of religious inspiration. Maybe you'll be surprised, but I'd count among such totalitarianism the whole history of the Christendom. Right, I'm not completely convinced that this was as salutary a kind of political and social arrangements as some of my colleagues do. John Winthrop's Massachusetts Bay Colony was such. Sometimes I tease my American fellow Americans that America was founded as a Taliban state. And, you know, if you compare Taliban laws to John Winthrop's laws about public worship, about adultery, about blasphemy, and so forth, the differences aren't very huge, right? The difference is that Taliban are for this today, whereas this was kind of 17th century. But still, or Calvin's Geneva, as well, in today's world, we think of Saudi Arabia or some other countries. Very unforgiving toward all heretics and schismatics of blasphemers and apostates, and anyone who deviates from the convictions and practices that the single exclusivist religion espouses, and then that a state not just endorses, but enforces with the power of its apparatus. Now, political pluralism is what I've sketched earlier in Richard Johnston lecture. Basically, all have equal political rights and equal voice in running the affairs of common public life. That means also Christian voice. That means also Muslim voice. That means also all varieties of voices have equal access to public space on their own grounds. And the state is impartial toward all overarching interpretations of life. So now you have this religious exclusivism and pluralism on one side, and then political exclusivism and pluralism on the other side. And there is a prevalent sentiment that correlates religious pluralism with political pluralism. And then that correlates, correspondingly, religious exclusivism with political exclusivism. And it's present almost like a default position among many. I remember I was teaching this course on faith and globalization with ex-Prime Minister Tony Blair. He and I had a number of debates offline, and one of the online debates in front of the whole class concerned just this issue. His default position was, or his position was, that roughly all the religious exclusivists are in the process not of secularizing so much, but becoming religious pluralists. And when they become religious pluralists, then they will also line up and become political pluralists. My argument to him was, well, if we wait until all religious people in the world become religious pluralists so that they can become political pluralists, I think we all will be dead for a long time before that day arrives. Chances of converting all religious exclusivists into religious pluralists so that you can have political peace are equal to zero, at least equal to zero in the foreseeable future. Therefore, if we cannot correlate religious exclusivism with political pluralism, we have a problem that we have to deal with. Luckily, I think we can. But before I go and I'll make that argument, I want to kind of give more time and space to the critics of my position, to those who would think more like Tony Blair did. And yesterday I quoted this famous passage from The End of Social Contract, Jean-Jacques Rousseau's famous text, "Those to distinguish civil intolerance from theological intolerance are, in my opinion, mistaken. These two kinds of intolerance are inseparable." And so it's his insistence that if you have religious exclusivism, religious intolerance, you're going to be also intolerant in political sphere as well. Now, maybe the best way to show that Rousseau was wrong is simply to say, well, I know so many religiously intolerant people who live in big cities, drive on subways with other people. Maybe they're just perfectly fine, right? Living their lives. And maybe Rousseau may respond, well, except that maybe these folks aren't either consistent, or he may say that they aren't quite applying their vision and their understanding, religious understanding, to public affairs. And the question then is, again, we'll return back to it, what kinds of internal resources do faiths have, does Christian faith have, when it affirms that it is religiously exclusivistic to embrace pluralism as a political project? Now, interesting thing that you find in Rousseau is, and you find it with all folks who correlate religious exclusivism and political kind of pluralism or proper democracy, you find them being rather politically exclusivistic themselves. Consider just a few paragraphs after the one that I have read that what Rousseau writes. Now that there is and there can be no longer any exclusive national religion, right? That's kind of his position. That's probably given today. We should tolerate all of those which tolerate others. So far, their dogmas, now listen to this, so far as their dogmas have nothing contrary to the duties of a citizen. Okay, maybe we can follow this so far. And then he says, but whosoever dares to say, outside the church, no salvation. That's your classical Catholic teaching, still, I think, on the books. Ought to be driven from the state, unless the state be the church and the prince be the pontiff. Such dogma is proper only in a theocratic government. In any other, it is pernicious. And so you've got this correlation, religious exclusivism, political exclusivism, therefore religious exclusivism ought to be suppressed. And so you have a pattern that is set here and that has been repeated, I think, throughout the history kind of Rousseau's followers. You can see it in Marx, you can see it in others as well. Now, So this is more about the truth of the position, right? If you're intolerant, if you claim the truth to your conviction, then you're going to be intolerant. There is the other argument that's being made, and you can see that if you look at the work of somebody like Karl Popper, and that is about access to truth, way we come to know the truth. And remember Karl Popper, who wrote the book Open Society and Its Enemies? And he wrote it not too far from here. He wrote it in New Zealand. He wrote it between 38 and 43, tucked away in New Zealand and casting a worried eye on the aggressive totalitarianisms of Stalin's Soviet Union and of Hitler's Germany. And his primary targets are philosophers of the closed society, for those of you who have read the book, Plato, Hegel, and Marx. But he fires shots also at world faiths as well. And you may recall that Popper differentiates between the kind of rational and irrational attitudes. And rational attitudes is readiness to be open to critical arguments and learn from experience, and kind of irrational argument is basically to rest fundamentally on some assumption and be closed for the further argument. And this reliance on passions, there is a reliance on, we would say, revelation, he argued divides humankind into different categories. And then ultimately ends up giving different rights also to different categories of people. And his argument is basically, and other people have taken it up, is that for religious people, there is a point. It's not that religious people don't use reason. Obviously, you can't utter properly a sentence without using reason. So we all use reason, and he recognizes this. But he says that for religious folks, at some point, kind of reason stops and gives way to revelation. And what I think significant is that reason seems to stop when the most fundamental decisions are made about nature of ultimate reality, about nature of the world, and about humanity. When decisions are being made about who I am, how I ought to relate to others and what is the good that I ought to pursue and what is the nature of reality. These things for the Christian tradition and for the great religions as well are kind of givens. And so the question is, well, can people whose reasoning stops at some point, can they also then be tolerant toward others, or will the intolerance kick in? Popper argued that they can't. If you have something of this kind of attitude, you will definitely have a closed society. Closed society which won't be able to tolerate alternatives in the end. Now, before I come to my hero, Roger Williams, I want to address one possible objection, and I want to invoke a sociologist. And sociologist here is Peter Berger. And the question which his work arises is this one. It may be that religious exclusivists are necessarily also political exclusivists. But we shouldn't worry too much about it. Not because somehow religious exclusivists will be converted to become religious pluralists, and then they're going to become political pluralists, not because of some kind of a conversion that's going to happen, but because when they're set in the conditions of pluralism and plurality, that will relativize positions that they take. In other words, if you are in a situation of religious pluralism, you're likely to become pluralistic yourself. Your exclusivism is going to be undermined. There's a book, Far Glory, that he has written, kind of series of articles. Otherwise, Peter Berger, some of you have read his work. I mean, he's a very respectable sociologist. He talks about social pluralism, which by this he means the coexistence with a measure of civic peace of different groups in one society. That's basically what we all experience, right? He thinks it erodes religious exclusivism and leads to religious pluralism, the belief that roughly all religions are equally true and good. And it does so, he uses a term to describe this, by so-called cognitive contamination. Cognitive contamination. Here's what he writes. The thought obtrudes that one's traditional ways of looking at the world may not be only plausible ones. That maybe those other people have a point or two. The worldview that until now was taken for granted is opened up or contaminated, right? Very slightly at first, to a glimmer of doubt. This opening has a way of expanding rapidly. The end point may be then a pervasive relativism. When people of different faiths live side by side, a robust and pure faith gradually morphs into a weak and contaminated faith, which in turn slides into outright secularity. So there's kind of argument for social psychology, and it somehow seems plausible in certain ways. First, you live with others, and over time, learn to appreciate them as human beings. Then you realize that their beliefs are not utterly false, their ways of living not so pernicious, and then eventually you conclude that their truth is as good as your truth. That's roughly the slide that he describes. Yet as neat as such schema looks, actually when sociologists observe what happens in situation of plurality, and good examples are India and, for instance, United States, it actually happens that in a situation of plurality, it stabilizes and strengthens individual convictions. True, that taken for granted beliefs tend to be eroded. You can't take your beliefs for granted, but just because you can take them for granted doesn't mean that you give them up. In fact, you may embrace them much more consciously and therefore stabilize your beliefs, and so that your exclusivism may be heightened. And that's especially the case also as pluralism creates, which is what Berger recognizes, creates a condition of permanent uncertainty as to what one should believe and how one should live. But the human mind abhors uncertainty, especially when it comes to the really important concerns of life. And so he describes this kind of movement from kind of certainties that we have to gradual relativization. Then you come to the point where you can't stand it anymore, and then you move back, right? Situational pluralism can strengthen our beliefs, strengthen our resolve to embrace and hold on to sturdily onto beliefs. So we can't quite get rid of exclusivism, as some people think. Neither will some of us religious folks convert, nor will the world kind of seduce us to simply leave those beliefs. And so the challenge remains, can we embrace then political pluralism? Ought we embrace political pluralism? Now, as you know by now, I'm a firm believer in political pluralism, and I am so just because of my Christian convictions. And it's good to have great kind of predecessors in this, and none is better than Roger Williams. That's the same guy who was passing by the prison in which Thomas Helvis was thrown when he was very wisely sent his book to the king to read how king has lost all the power over the souls of his subjects. Roger Williams is a very interesting man. He came to Massachusetts Bay Colony, a colony that was, well, a kind of a Taliban state, and he was a very close friend of John Winthrop. And when he arrived in February of 1631, the leaders received him, and here's the quote, as a godly and zealous preacher. He was a young man, 28 years of age, and he was offered one of the most important positions in a deeply religious English America. He was to be teacher, a kind of resident religious thinker of the Boston Church, kind of almost like the most important religious personality in that deeply religious state. Now, to their surprise, Roger Williams refused the honor. For him, the Boston Puritans were not separate enough from the Church of England. 5 years later, just a few months before they founded Harvard College, the magistrates purged the colony of the man who would be their teacher on account of his impurity. The man who wouldn't be their teacher because he considered them impure. What was his unpardonable offense? He advocated the seditious doctrine that magistrates had no right to enforce obedience to the first table of the law, the portion of the Ten Commandments, of course, that regulates human duties to God. And then he ended up writing these big tomes and having long debates about that very issue. And in 1644, he wrote a book, and in the introduction, he writes, "It is the will and command of God that since the coming of his Son, the Lord Jesus, a permission of the most paganish, Jewish, Turkish, or anti-Christian consciousness and worships be granted in all nations and countries, and they are only to be fought with that sword which is only in soul matters able to conquer, with the sword of God's Spirit, the Word of God." That was kind of a revolutionary idea. And it wasn't enough for him to advocate the idea. He moved to Rhode Island. He was banished to Rhode Island. And he established political institutions to articulate precisely this vision embodied in this very simple and for us today, I think, uncontested statement. Roger Williams, one of his biographers, concludes, "With absolute faith in the Bible, with absolute faith in his own interpretation of the Bible," here's your exclusivist if you're looking for one, "he nonetheless believed it monstrous to compel another person to believe what he or anyone else believed, or to compel conformity to his or anyone else's belief. Here you have an example, in fact, of religious exclusivism at the foundation of the project of political pluralism. And I could never quite understand why the appeal, and in what ways the appeal of political exclusivism is so strong in the imagination, especially of contemporaries today. Again, reminder, Catholic Church has embraced freedom of religion only at the Vatican II. Most controversial, most radical of the documents is the document on religious freedom. This kind of experience of religious freedom, which I take for granted, which indeed Catholic Church today takes for granted. Think of John Paul II. Think of Benedict XVI. They're champions of religious freedom, which just recently has been promulgated to the pride of place in Catholic thought. But this idea that we somehow, because we are obedient to God, we somehow have to make the space Christian, which has such a powerful hold on our imagination. Christian right in America, though it embraces pluralism as a political project in some ways institutionally, still hankers to the idea of America as a Christian nation. I think it has just to be given up. I think resonances are there, of course, with what one finds in the Old Testament. And that's what served as a pattern for Massachusetts Bay, city set on a hill. The idea of prophetic engagement and therefore transformation of whole society. Those ideas are very powerful. I don't think they're right. I think in many ways that they're deeply contrary to the gospel. So that engagement with public sphere has to take different shape, not because contemporary pluralistic societies foist themselves upon us and therefore we can't avoid but being marginal and therefore not foisting ourselves upon the whole society, but this is actually the right thing to do. A kind of pluralism is not settling for kind of inadequate solution on account of our inability to do better than that. It is the expression of the character of the Christian faith, and the character of the Christian faith, I think, which precisely places responsibility for a life of a person in that person's own hands. Call is to Abraham, leave your country. He can be held back. He can be said, no conversion, Mr. Abraham. Apostasy is not allowed. Once the call comes, there's apostasy. You leave what is there, and you embark upon an uncertain journey. That's the kind of soteriological presupposition of the foundations, I think, of political pluralism. And that's also anthropological presupposition of it, especially then if we add to it the moral dimension of it, namely the embrace of the golden rule, as I've emphasized yesterday. I think we've got what we need, and if we don't take that, I think we're at odds with the character of the Christian faith. Christendom Project is a mistaken project. Massachusetts Bay was a mistaken project. Not kind of failure due to obstruction from outside, but failure structurally from within the Christian faith itself. It'll have as a consequence certain forms of marginality, and John nicely pointed out how marginality does not mean absence of influence, how sitting in prison, you know, the gospel can run. Martin Luther expressed it in more kind of boisterous terms. You know, he wrote his little things, sent them into the world, and then he was sitting and drinking his beer, and the gospel was going through the world. I think the kind of attitude also that takes it for granted that it's not we who convert. We are pointers to something. We provide space between us and the other person who embraces or doesn't embrace a way of life, Christ. And that's also, I think, a structural element in the very fabric of the Christian faith, again, rather than a kind of settling for the second best. I think at the heart of this issue is also another kind of deep Christian conviction, and that is the relationship between the church and the kingdom. There's a lot of kingdom theology floating around, which I think is an expression of over-realized eschatology. There's a distinction between church and the kingdom, fundamental distinction between church and the kingdom. Church participates in the kingdom, but it isn't the kingdom. Kingdom is larger than the church. Kingdom is this work where church is not, and kingdom isn't fully realized where the church is. Kingdom is something that is always already there everywhere, but it's also always something toward which we and the world might be moving. Thank you very much.